Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Be sure to check us out online at www.wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now enjoy this edition of the Midweek Podcast.
All right, so we are here with this Midweek Podcast with Joshua Cutchin and Red Pill Junkie. Hello, guys.
Good evening.
How did you do?
And I am going to kind of just turn this over to you guys a little bit here to talk about Paramania that you went to last weekend.
Yeah, April 1st through 3rd, the first annual Paramania Unconference, as it were, in Dallas, mm-hmm. Texas. It was a wonderful...
What does it mean by unconference?
non-ticketed. Nobody made any money off of it. Nobody paid any money to go. Just show up and hang out. There were some loosely organized lectures, and most of it was just hanging out and talking with people that you admire. And, it was basically ideas shared over a pint for most of the weekend.
Nice.
Yeah, because you see that some people really don't have an interest in attending a big conference like the UFO Congress or something like that, because they don't find appealing the idea of sitting for a number of hours listening, passively to some speaker give a presentation, and then a Q&A, then 15 minutes for a break, and then on to the next presentation, and on and on and on. It's great, if you are really interested in the subject, but what is really even greater about attending conferences is what happens afterward, when the presentations are over and everybody is headed into the bar, and then you meet all these cool people you've always heard about, and you ask them questions, and most of them are more than willing to hang around with you for a few minutes or maybe a few hours, depending on the mood of the night. And that is the thing we wanted to focus on this unconference that was Paramania in Dallas, Texas.
So in a lot of ways, it was like a 3-day after party, which was a lot of fun. And we were able mm-hmm. to, we were able to, we had our lectures on the second day. The first day we actually went out to Dealey Plaza, which I'd love to talk about. I think there's a lot to talk about there. And then the last day we went to Aurora, Texas, which is the home of the 1897 alleged airship crash. Right. So it was some nice little enough structure to give us some guidance throughout the day, but not so much that we couldn't go, oh, well, let's change this at the last minute, or let's push this back an hour so that we can take more time to have lunch or something like that. It was a nice, flexible sort of schedule.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is that the number of people who actually attended the event was very manageable. I mean, it wasn't like a large crowd. I remember Greg Taylor, who was, well, he wasn't an organizer, but he was one of the main reasons that the Paramania ended up happening, because one of his big fans, Steve Ray, he came up with the idea. He told Greg, if I were to fly you to Dallas, Texas, would you be willing to speak to a bunch of people that I managed to gather? And Greg said, yeah, obviously. I mean, free flight, and staying in Dallas, why not?
RPJ, did you say Greg Taylor or Greg Bishop?
Greg Bishop, sorry. Okay. Oh, my God.
That's all right. That's all right.
Sorry, you guys.
No worries.
and Tim Binal, the host of Binal of America, heard about that. And he got right on board, and also because Tim is a big wrestling fan. So the trip to Dallas will coincide with this big event happening in Dallas called WrestleMania. So that's why Tim actually came up with the name Paramania. So
nice.
It was all that thing that came up together very organically. Obviously, there was a certain amount of logistics and organization that had to be put, and Steve Ray is to be greatly commended, because he did an outstanding job. He made sure
yes.
that that everybody felt really, really nice and really, really glad to have gone through the effort of going to Dallas. And I think, I mean, everything went without a hitch, wouldn't you say, Joshua?
Absolutely. I mean, there was it was incredibly smooth the entire time. And what's more, I never saw a negative emotion come out of Steve the entire weekend. It was quite remarkable. For instance, I think I went to bed around 4:30 on Sunday morning, and I had to leave at 7 to get on my flight, and Steve was bright-tailed and bushy-eyed right there to pick me up. I'm like, what time did you go to bed? I don't even know if he went to sleep at all. But yeah, he was the most accommodating and positive host I have ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, on the first day, I arrive on – I think most of us arrive on Thursday. I arrived around I think it was 3:30 p.m., and he and team, you know, just waited on the Dallas-Fort Worth airport to pick me up. I mean, I think a team had arrived an hour earlier, so the guys decided to wait for me. And then after that, Steve took us to lunch to a really unusual place. You know, it was something of a first time for me because I really – it never occurred to me to have lunch in a strip bar.
Yeah.
And as soon as we arrived there, I thought, oh my God, is this going to be like the tone of the whole Paramania trip? You know, Tim and I kept looking at each other and say, well, I mean, okay, I guess we have to make the most of it, because Steve kept telling us, you know, not that the food in this place was great, and it was. And it was really awkward seeing all these girls trying to come up with us and say, do you want some company? And I said, no, thank you. You know, we're just talking here.
Now, in case anyone is put off by the idea of going to a paranormal conference and attending a strip club, I actually made it out there and did not go. So don't let that keep you away. I feel like there might have been a person or two who got wind that that might be happening and didn't end up coming to Paramania this year. But
but that wasn't really like the tone of the trip at all. You know, that was like something of a one-off. And after that, you know, everything else went marvelously, you know, including the last party that we had on Sunday night at this really, really, really nice, luxurious place in one of the, I guess, the best neighborhoods in Dallas, you know.
That beautiful
was,
home.
Yeah, that was put... You know, but by a friend of Steve's, you know, who was so kind to open his doors to all these, a bunch of strangers, actually. You know, I mean, he didn't know any of us, but nonetheless, he was there. You know, he played the role of the really gracious host. And it was at first it was kind of intimidating, like, what the hell are we doing here?
Like an opening scene from Eyes Wide Shut or something.
Something like that. Yeah, I was expecting naked women and guys clad with Venetian masks, you know, coming anytime soon. But at the end, when we started to learn more about our host, you know, and seeing what kind of person he was, you know, he seems to be a really, really smart individual and really approachable. I mean, I was really, really amazed, you know, how approachable he was. Then everything became much more relaxing, I guess, you know, and that was kind of like almost the end of Paramania, because a small group of us headed down to our hotel room where Greg and I were like giving away a whole bunch of copies of Greg's book, It Defies Language, and all these posters that he printed in LA. And also I was giving away all the Keep Calm and Take the Red Pill t-shirts that I had brought from Mexico.
Yeah, and I think it was Tim Banal who pointed out, he took a photo on Facebook and pointed out how much it looked like a drug deal, like a late night drug deal, with all these different paranormal books spread out over the bed sheets and money was flying everywhere.
Yeah, that is the kind of things, you know, when people gather in the hotel rooms at 3 a.m. That is one of the things you remember the most when you attend these kind of events.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And so there were lectures and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Greg Bishop did sort of a walk through his past. He dredged up some old photos that he hadn't really shared with anybody, and shared some of that with us, which was fascinating and sort of a glimpse into that particular era of ufology. I stumbled through half of my MUFON presentation, which was okay, I guess. Anyway, moving on. Micah Hanks gave his ghost rocket speech, which was great. It was a nice little look into that aspect of the phenomena. And then lastly, Steve Ray, the organizer of the event, presented a really fascinating study on trying to track synchronicities throughout the Radio Misterioso broadcast. And it was a very novel approach, which, Miguel, would you like to speak us to that? Because you might be a little bit more articulate with it than I am.
Oh, I hope I am. I mean, I don't even sure if I will qualify them as synchronicities, because Steve and another Radio Misterioso long-time listener, Stephanie Kitsch, they came up with this idea of coming together with keywords and things that they will try to, I don't know if manifest is the right word for it. You know,
it was almost like podcast remote viewing.
Something like that, yeah. Like, okay, they came up with the idea of, for example, you know, okay, we're going to see if we're going to pick the word cow and see if something happens during the show in which something alluding to cow is recorded or is brought up during the live session. And, you know, sure enough, in one of the most blatant examples of this experiment, Greg played as the only song that Greg played during that live show, that particular live show. At the beginning of the song, there is the sound of a cow mooing. You know, so Steve and Stephanie were coming up with is a really novel and a really original way to use modern tools like, obviously, the internet and using Excel spreadsheets in order to track down this uncanny either coincidence or remote viewing, whichever term you wish to use. But
yeah, I don't think that synchronicity works, because you're trying to create it. Synchronicity is more of an unconscious thing.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Right.
But yeah, I think that's sort of where the outgrowth of the impetus for the project sort of began there. But yeah, it definitely looked a lot more like a remote viewing project. And they went to pretty great lengths to make sure that it was very clear that they didn't go back and sort of fudge the data. They recorded their conversations where they decided their code word, and they had timestamps with those. And then they also live recorded the actual Radio Misterioso broadcast as it went by. Because I don't think Greg always includes songs and such when he puts the podcast online. So they really did a good job of trying to keep it on the up and up.
Yeah, they were very thorough in their approach. Obviously, there could be some improvements. One, for instance, obviously the first improvement is they could enroll more people into you know, replicating the results. Obviously, and this is something that Steve's was encouraging us to do. I mean, like, you know, pick up this idea, you know, take the ball and go with it. You know, so instead of two persons trying to record this manifestations, occurrences, you could have maybe 5-10 people, you know, going about doing that. And maybe you could also do some kind of what they call in psychic or psychological investigations, the double blinded protocols, you know, because obviously the two of them were choosing the keywords that they were trying to track in Radio Mysteriosus podcasts. But maybe you could have some kind of computer program that will choose a completely random keyword for them, you know, so adding some, even another level of, what do you call this, objectivity, I guess, you know, because maybe skeptics will say that they are already biased because they know Greg's show so well. They could maybe, you know, unconsciously know the kind of words that will be more frequent to be said during the show or to be mentioned in the songs that Greg likes to play. But I think that they were really trying to go for the completely unexpected word. Like, I mean, cow. I mean, why would...
Yeah, cow's an odd one.
Yeah, cow's an odd one. You know, maybe if Greg had Chris O'Brien as a guest, you know, say, well, obviously they're going to talk about cows because, you know,
right.
Greg, Chris is a cattle mutilation researcher. But, yes. Yeah, it's something like that, I think, has great potential for further research.
Okay, that's really interesting.
Another one of my favorite synchronicities, or one of my favorite sort of, I guess, predictive moments was Stephanie and Steve would have this discussion, and the keyword would sort of emerge organically out of that discussion, and one of the words was heat. And in the middle of his broadcast, Greg actually had to go out of his studio to move his car, right?
Oh, you yeah, know? I think that it's... The car was burning or something like that.
Because the car near his car was started smoking and had an engine fire, yeah. Which is another one of those moments. It's like, wow, I can't believe that happened. So I would go so far as to say if anyone wants to do something like this with Where Did the Road Go, I just put something on the forums or write me at my site, and I'll find a way to get you in contact with Steve. I'm sure Steve would be glad to share his methodology with you. And then after you talk to Steve, don't talk to anybody else about it. Don't talk to me about it. Don't talk to Sarai about it. Don't talk to Miguel about it. But I think it would be an interesting thing to see if this sort of is replicable in other areas.
Sure, because the thing that has to be said is that Greg Bishop didn't know a thing about this experiment. You know, he didn't learn about it until like one day prior to Steve's presentation. And I think that's key, you know, this idea of not giving away your intentions. I think Steve said something about that the phenomenon will manifest more when Greg had more of a loose end or a more informal kind of show.
Right.
You know?
If it was a music show or a guest he was really comfortable with, as opposed to a really solidly, tightly structured interview.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. You want to talk a little bit about Daily Plaza there?
Yes. Mm-hmm, sure. Yeah. My initial thoughts are, the things that I keep on coming back to are: A, it's much smaller than you think it is. It's quite a tiny space. The book depository was a lot smaller than closer rather than you think it was. But also, I've never been to a place where I've had a sense of geography really helping me understand the events more than at Dealey Plaza.
Mm-hmm.
How so?
Just to see how, just to get the lay of the land in terms of the direction of the grassy knoll and how close that was and what sort of an angle it would provide and how, yes, someone shooting from the grassy knoll would result in a back into the left motion. And to also get an idea for why some of the conspiracy theories seem to hold a little bit more water. I mean, I came in being sort of indifferent about the whole, you know, second shooter angle. But I really did emerge
a lot more convinced of it after seeing all the things, and in some ways not seeing the things that had to do with that particular spot in Dallas.
Okay, what about you, Red Pill?
Well, it was overwhelming at some point. I mean, I have obviously watched the movie JFK many, many times. My sister used to have it on VHS, and we used to watch it on numerous occasions. So I was, you know, already very biased, honestly, about the idea of a major conspiracy. But then you're confronted by what Joshua said, you know, the being at the actual place where it all happened. You know, you have this sense being in the presence of a place where the world history really took a really, really steep turn into another direction. You know, this is a place where it's not important, not only in American history, it's important in world history. I remember my mother telling me how when she was working as a secretary in 1963, that her boss came up to the office and told her and the other staff members that what had happened in Dallas, and that everybody left early that day, and you know they went into their homes. Some people were crying. Some people were crying there because I don't think people in the United States have a sense of how amazingly popular JFK was outside of the United States. And I think that also people, I'm sure that people were scared. I'm sure that more than one people in Mexico and another place, and I'm sure in the United States as well, were kind of expecting like the end of the world, you know, right after the end, the death of JFK, when it was obviously something quite possible that, in the mindset of the people at that moment in history. But getting back and my impressions on the Daily Plaza, seeing the X that was painted in the pavement, where the government or the expert assumed that the fatal shot happened. And seeing all those tourists taking smiling selfies, you know, right there on that X, that was weird. And I'm sorry to admit, I felt it was kind of disrespectful. I mean, it's like, I don't think I would have, you know, like chosen to smile and say, it's like, I don't know. If you're a Christian and you go to the Holy Land and say, oh, well, this is where, you know, we think that the cross of Christ, you know, was put, and you will take a selfie. Hey, I'm here with, you know, Christ, you know, was nailed to the cross. Okay, and Getty, we also went to the grassy knoll where the conspiracy corner, as I like to call it, is put. Well, these two guys giving their usual spiel about the conspiracy and about the second shooter and all that, and showing the really gnarly, the really gross and really graphic frames from the Zapruder film, which, interestingly enough, are not present in the actual official JFK Museum. You know, the part when you can see the back and to the left, and you can see half of JFK's head blown to pieces, and you can see his wife either trying to escape or trying to get a reaction from the Secret Service agents. Those frames are nowhere to be seen inside the museum, and I found that interesting. What I found, I think, most interesting is not what was presented during the exhibition, but the things that they deliberately omitted. You know, the things that you are not shown inside the official exhibition, the official telling of what happened on that day. The fact that you can't, the fact that you cannot actually step into the corner window because it is, you know, encircled, you know, encased in this glass cage, you know, and you can only see the actual, what they call is like the point of view from that, that corner using a camera, you know. All those things, you know, were weird.
Yeah, and it's one of those situations too that so much time and energy is given in that museum to the conspiracy theories. It's almost one of those "the lady doth protest too much" sort of scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I also found it interesting, again, coming back to the geography, if there was a lone shooter, he would not have, his clearest shot would have been right at the intersection, literally right below the door, the window rather, at the book depository. And to have waited as long as he did, you know, he was so much closer to where the alleged second shooter would have been, than he would have been if he had just taken the shot right there at the intersection. It really makes me think, it really put a lot of extra weight behind that theory for me.
That's one of those things where I don't have any doubt that the story we're told is simply false.
Mm-hmm.
It's just one of those things where the evidence, the official story really doesn't add up at all.
Right. Right. And it's also, I mean, so it just comes down to a matter of, you know, who was behind it and who was implicated and why was it done?
I think it was probably multiple parties. I don't think it was one party. I mean, so he pissed off so many people. You know, everyone from other elements of the government and the CIA to, you know, the mafia.
Yeah, it reminds me of that Onion headline that says Kennedy slain by CIA, mafia, Castro, LBJ, Teamsters, Freemasons.
Exactly.
President shot 129 times from 43 different angles. Yeah.
Sure.
What's a really interesting book on it is actually the Bush Family Jewels from, I forget his name. Hang on. I got to look. It's the guy that does whowhatwhy.com.
Oh, well, a friend of mine, Jesse Rocha.
Russ Baker.
He pointed me out to this documentary, Dark Legacy, that he urged me to look at because I think in that particular film, they discuss the possible implications of the Bush family into the death of JFK.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what Russ Baker does. It's Family of Secrets, I think, is the actual name of the book. It's like 800 pages long. It's ridiculous. Very well researched. Not really any speculation thrown in, but like he started writing it because he heard George W. Bush say that the older Bush there that was a president in the 80s, that's G.W., right?
Yeah.
Or Herbert, that's Herbert Walker.
Yeah.
Anyway, someone had asked him, where were you when Kennedy got shot? And he said, I don't remember. And Russ said, what do you mean you don't remember? Who doesn't remember where they were when Kennedy got shot? So he tried to find out. And it turns out that he was in Dallas on the day Kennedy got shot, having a meeting with some other high-level people, most of which were connected to Oswald. And when Kennedy was actually shot, he was just a short distance away giving a speech at some Republican convention. They came up, told him that Kennedy was shot. He announced it and then very calmly went over and sat down.
Wow.
He then called the CIA with a bad tip. And said he was calling from somewhere he was not. So when you look at all this, it's like, what is he doing here? Like, what's really going on? I mean, obviously, he wasn't directly responsible for shooting JFK, but was some kind of decision made that morning?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald, who was a notorious anti-Castro activist, the fact that he had been in the army, the Air Force, he had been stationed in this Japanese base where the U-2 secret spy planes used to be launched, and the fact that then he defected to Russia. And obviously the CIA and the government will be sure to assume that he will give secrets to the Russians. And then he was permitted to return to the United States, and instead of being thrown into jail for treason, you know, he was welcomed into the country. He was allowed to enter the United States with his new Russian wife. And you're telling me they weren't keeping an eye on him?
Yeah. It's because he was a CIA asset the whole time.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a really fair, I mean, non-tinfoil hatted assumption. You know?
Yeah. Because it doesn't make sense any other way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's direct connections to so many people that were high up in the CIA. He was obviously being run.
Mm-hmm.
So when he came out and said he was a patsy, he clearly understood that that's exactly what had happened to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even if I mean, I can't encourage people, even if they don't have a conspiratorial bent, to still go to the museum, because it's the... Even though access to the windows is restricted, it is interesting to see, like, the original light fixtures are there. They said that there are some scuff marks on the floor that were actually from the original police raid. The camera that was used to take Bob Jackson's iconic photo is there, as well as was Jack Ruby's hat that he was wearing when he shot Oswald. Yeah. There's so much that is preserved there that is just it's quite. It's quite impressive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Oh, and also the fact that at the facade, you know, on one of the sides of the building, there is this metal plaque where someone, you know, some good conspiratory citizen, you know, scratched the word allegedly, you know, the fact where it reads that Oswald allegedly shot JFK, someone, you know,
took a penny and like scraped around it a dozen times.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I took a picture of that. It was cool.
Well, I think what people don't realize too, if they don't really look into it, is that Oswald was never tried and found guilty.
Yep. And neither was Osama bin Laden.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true too. I know you don't necessarily think there was a conspiracy with 9/11. I think there was. I just don't know that it was necessarily what people think it is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more likely to think Israel had something to do with it, or some elements in Israel had something to do with it, mm-hmm. and maybe some elements in our government allowing something to happen.
It's an interesting take.
But there are pieces that don't fit in the official story. They simply don't fit. And I think the government's going to lie no matter what.
Yeah,
because they want to spin it to their advantage.
Yeah, maybe the reasons the pieces don't fit is because some pieces have been deliberately covered up. But maybe those pieces were covered up in order to hide not a evil conspiracy, but only just blatant incompetence.
Well, that is entirely possible. But there's also things like the way Building 7 fell, which is definitely suspicious. Mm. You know, I know that when you look at the, what was the group that did the report on it? Anyway, they came, it took them 7 years to figure out how to explain how Building 7 fell like it did.
Mm.
And when you look at that, you also got to realize they weren't trying to figure out what caused Building 7 to fall. They were charged with finding out, with the government's explanation, how Building 7 could have fallen based on that explanation. And it took them 7 years to come up with something.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, so sometimes I wonder if it's not just opportunism that is mistaken for conspiracy.
Well, that's entirely possible.
But at the same time, I still think the conspiracy angle is entirely possible. I mean, it totally seems feasible, too.
But no matter what happened, we don't know the truth.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that obviously all the people who were, most of the people who were there that day at the Daily Plaza, I think it's fair to say that these were like conspiracy tourists. You know, I mean, the Daily Plaza has become a spot of what we could call conspiracy tourism. And I wonder if 20, 50 years from now, similar thing will happen on Ground Zero in New York. You know, well, you have that the government will allow a conspiracy corner where people will be talking about, Building 7 on the thermite and all the old things and yada, yada, yada. You know, well, while they will have their official museum of the, giving the official interpretation of what happened on 9/11.
Yeah, be interesting to see.
Yeah.
And of course, like with Dallas, we'll probably never know the real story.
Well, when are they supposed to release the files they still keep secret? 2039? I keep.
Yeah, well, like they keep kicking it forward. And it's very possible they're kicking it forward because some of the people it's going to implicate are still alive.
Well, yeah, I mean.
Yeah.
The senior Bush still alive, yeah, right?
Yeah, and so if that implicates him in any way, you know damn well he's not letting that get released.
Yeah, and neither are their sons.
Even if after he dies, I don't think they would release it because it's just going to be this cascading domino effect.
That's why it's been pushed up so far. Because at that point, people aren't going to care as much.
Yeah.
It'll be ancient history. It's 50 years ago or so, whatever the date is.
100th anniversary, maybe.
Yeah, and maybe they're hoping people will just forget about it.
I don't think that will happen entirely. I mean, looking at all the people who were there at the Daily Plaza, and all the people, I mean, you should have seen the lines waiting to enter the JFK Museum, Soraya. I mean, it was pretty packed.
But will it be 50 years from now?
It's a good question. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of people still going to Holy Land, you know?
True, but that's a little different.
Maybe it will become something of a sacred site in America for people to go and, you know, pay the respects and even pray to JFK.
I really don't know. I mean, I would like to. I have not had the chance to go to Pearl Harbor yet, but I would like to see how Pearl Harbor at, you know, noon on a Thursday or noon on a Friday in April looks compared to, you know, Dealey Plaza or to compared to the Kennedy Museum, because that place was definitely packed.
Yeah.
But Pearl Harbor, too, doesn't have the same conspiracies associated with it. I mean, there are some.
True. Yeah. I do love the Pearl Harbor conspiracies, though. I think they're great.
Well, you know, the one thing we have evidence of is that they, at least some people knew it was coming and didn't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's come out pretty definitively, you know, but not necessarily because they were trying to cause a problem as much as they just didn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to say. You know, and who know? You know, they're very good at keeping information out of our hands.
Yeah.
Or if it gets in our hands, it's very easy at this point to make it seem ridiculous.
What's undeniable is that the JFK assassination is the true beginning of the conspiracy mindset.
Yes.
In America and the rest of the schism, when the people started to really doubt the veracity of official stories, started to really distrust their elected officials. And and that is something that is really fascinating to me. I mean, it's something that I keep thinking about, how now we're living in an age in which I don't think there's been an age in human history with such low levels of public distrust in government. I don't know, maybe in Roman times, I don't know. I mean,
you're right. But that was a turning point for so many reasons. Yeah. That's one of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to see how many people you talk to who say, you know, oh, well, I think they're crooked as hell, but I'm still going to vote for so-and-so, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, okay, well, that's what we've come to.
Yeah.
Well, I think you know, you hear, okay, well, Congress has this low approval rating, and yet they keep getting reelected, and that's because people think, yeah, it's the other guys who are doing the bad job. Our guy's good.
Yeah.
And so, hence, we just keep reelecting the same people who don't do anything except make things worse.
Or you vote for the lesser evil and say, well, you know, I don't like this guy, but I'm sure as hell don't like the other guy to win, so I better vote for his opponent.
And I think that the powers that be, whatever they may be, shadow government, the U.S. government, whatever you want, that's exactly where they want us, is they want us at each other's throats.
I don't even know if it's a shadow government so much as it's just corporate controlled.
That too.
You know, you have all these people making sure that the people that are going to give them the best deal get into office. It's money.
I think the way I see it, it's not an evil cabal of people, you know, like pulling the strings of world events. It's a well-oiled automatic engine, you know, that is running, you know, out. It's
running on greed,
exactly, you know, and it's pulling us all out of pure inertia. And the people who learn the rules of the game are the people who manage to climb on top quicker, you know, and they learn these rules, you know, almost instinctively. And so there's no need to have some kind of like overseers trying to see if someone steps out of line or seeing, oh, no, this guy, you know, is starting to doubt the official question, so we better shut him up. No, that's going to happen automatically. You know, he's just going to be, if he's a reporter, he's either going to get fired or he's going to be, you know, demoted or sent to cover the really boring news. And I think that's obviously the same happens with politicians, you know, this well-maintained machine or beast, if you wanted to look at it that way, you know, it will instinctively ensure that only the most crooked individuals, the ones more willing to make deals under the table, and the ones with the most skeletons in their closets, will be the ones who will get elected in order to keep feeding the beast.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to the UFO crash site.
The alleged UFO crash.
The alleged, yes. Well, I think all UFO crash sites are alleged
crash sites.
But now this happened in what year? In 1897?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
April of 1897, yeah.
April 17th
or 12th, I can't remember off the top of my head.
Something like
I think
that.
17th sounds right. In Aurora, Texas, allegedly there was an airship of some description, that cigar-shaped airship that crashed into the town windmill and landed near the town well. The pilot was disfigured and, according to reports at the time, appeared non-human. So being good Christian folk, they took him over to the cemetery, the Masonic cemetery, might I add, and buried him underneath a tree with a rough-hewn tombstone, and they actually were able to throw a good portion of the debris into the well near where it crashed. The tombstone has since been taken, and a large rock has been put in its place, and rumors persist that those who drank water from the well had an extremely aggressive form of arthritis develop and became ill. Shortly after that, the small town of Aurora really did sort of dry up and didn't really survive to this day. If you drive by it, you definitely have to know where you're going. You have to know where you're going to get to the cemetery and to actually see where the well is. We were lucky enough to have the organizer of an event that's coming up. It's the Aurora Alien Encounter, I believe. Is that right, Miguel?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
His name was Daniel Jones, and he was actually well-versed in the lore of the area and was able to not only give us a good idea of what was going on in the cemetery, but was also able to take us to the site of the well, which you can still see. But the nice special surprise was that Jim Mars was there to greet us at the cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, yeah. Interesting. Speaking of conspiracies.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
So what was your takeaway from it?
Well, yeah, I was struck by how mundane it all really sort of felt, which is something that I sort of touched on a little bit in a blog post that I put up. But as I mentioned, it's all very nondescript. It seems very odd to me, as I think Miguel has mentioned in some of his writing since then, that they would just go ahead and give this entity, whatever it was, a Christian burial. It doesn't seem like something that they would that people of 1897 Texas would do. You'd think that somebody would want to preserve it, or somebody would, you know, decry it as being something demonic or something along those lines. So it was really interesting to see this particular location. I'm maybe a little bit less sold on the idea of it being an actual event than I was before I went, in a lot of ways.
Okay. What about you, Red Pill?
Well, the thing that Joshua just mentioned. I mean, if this pilot that according to the newspaper article was not of this earth, had been so foreign or alien looking, you know, surely they wouldn't have gone through the trouble of giving him a Christian or even a Masonic burial. You know, they would have just, you know, burned it. And also the fact that if something exotic did crash with that windmill, well, it obviously didn't obliterate the whole town. So it didn't carry some kind of like small portion of antimatter.
right.
That
turned Aurora into this big hole in the sky, in the ground, sorry, this crater. And I would say, oh, here lied, like Tunguska, right? And us here lied, you know, the town of Aurora. And we don't know what happened. Maybe a comet, you know, maybe people will say nowadays that, yeah, we think that a comet crashed in Aurora, but we're not really sure. But nothing of the sort happened there. So, yeah, I mean, I tried to talk to Jim, you know, who I really found a really, really nice guy, although I don't agree with some of his ideas. I tried to talk to him about...
Maybe Gene who?
Gene Mars.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, Jim.
Yeah,
Jim. I thought you said Gene.
Yeah. My Mexican accent is is out of control. I was trying to talk to him about these theories about, you know, the Sonora Air Club. So all this, you know, trying to look into alternative theories, because I think in his mind this is already set in stone, you know, not unlike the landmark stone that it lies on the cemetery, that this was out of this world, and this aluminum was really exotic, and obviously this craft was electromagnetic, you know, because this is the way that this ship travel, and they defy gravity, and all these assumptions, all these given ideas into the narrative, that obviously makes a fascinating story, but there's so little evidence into the case. There's probably even less evidence than in Roswell, and we know how unreliable that story really is, right?
Well, it's frustrating because theoretically there should be a very easy way to prove whether the major parts of the story are true or not. But getting access to dig in the cemetery is getting permission to dig into the cemetery is a non-starter.
Didn't somebody look for it though?
I believe Monster Quest or Ancient Aliens, one or the other, took in some ground penetrating radar, but that's as far as they got.
And I don't think they found anything, whoever did.
Well, according to Jim, they did find evidence of a tomb of some sort, you know, that something is buried there. What that is, you know, God only knows. It occurred to me that when Jim mentioned that the some of the trees surrounding the burial site were very old, were probably around when the crash happened. You know, it occurred to me, well, what would happen if you will try to take some samples from the trees? You know, I mean, if you go through the rationale that maybe the exotic chemical composition of this, you know, foreign entity maybe had some kind of impact into the surrounding vegetation. I mean, maybe to look into.
And we have seen that in other UFO reports where the vegetation is affected.
Right. Yeah. Or tree ring growth too, to see if there was abnormal stunting of growth during the years that, you know, following the crash or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. But you know, it was really interesting and really, really, you know, fun to go see. And it's a fun little day trip. I would recommend anybody who's in that area that's interested in these sort of things should go. I do think that it is also interesting, you know, the sort of things that I'm interested in. I thought it was very interesting that it was a Masonic cemetery to begin with. Mm-hmm. But I also thought it was interesting. Correct me if I'm wrong, Miguel. There's a tombstone in there that has an SR-71 Blackbird on it, right?
Yeah, although I don't think we were able to
locate it. Apparently, there's. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's certainly not among the first tombstones, you know, at the beginning of the. At the entrance of the cemetery. Probably is on the back.
Why do you think that's relevant?
Well, I think it's interesting, you know, in terms of playing a Lauren Coleman-esque Twilight Language name game, you look at that and supposedly the aircraft that was the successor to the SR-71 that's long been rumored was the Aurora. So I think that's sort of interesting too in its own special way. But like I said, anyone who goes out there, the very least is that you're going to see some beautiful Texas countryside. So.
And do you want to tell people a little bit about what the Sonora Club was there, Red Pill, since you brought it up?
Well, I'm not really an expert into that. I think for that,
just give people an overview of what that means.
Okay, so apparently there was this guy, and the name escapes me, who painted a lot of really simplistic, you know, almost childish illustrations of all these really colorful airships. You know, something out of a Jules Verne's novel. And
Charles Delshow, I believe.
Yes, thank you very much, Master Kutchin. Yeah, exactly, Delshow. The story goes that Delshow was in contact with this organization. I think they either are named as NYMZA, NYMZA, or the Sonora Air Club. So the story is that there was this group of people who were actually building very advanced, at least for the time, airships, and they were, you know, testing them. And some of those airships were responsible for the massive flap that was reported on the newspapers, American newspapers, in 1997. Micah talked a bit about that at the actual whale site, you know, when after we left the cemetery. I have to say that I'm of two minds about the idea, because on the one hand, the concept of this steampunk breakaway civilization is really appealing to me. I don't know, maybe from an aesthetic point of view. But on the other hand, I find it conflicting because, look, if you look into the newspaper reports, you know, they describe these airships with these really potent searchlights.
Yeah.
You know, and if you think about the kind of generators that will have to be used in order to produce such powerful beams of light, that in itself is a problem when you take into consideration the weight that these airships will have to carry.
Not only that, but UFOs often have extremely blinding lights, even by today's standards. And that was described with the airships as well. I mean, a lot of the airships accounts are likely hoaxes.
Sure.
Or just newspaper stuff. But I think there's some in there that probably had some genuine reports.
Yeah, that's why a lot of the airship reports began, was people were awoken by a bright light shining through their window, and they went outside and people were like, can you fetch me a pail of milk, sonny?
Yeah, yeah. I'm surprised that didn't make your book.
A couple of them did. You know, it was sort of hard separating the wheat from the chaff on that.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the problem, because they're so long ago, and it's very hard to follow up. I know Chris Auerbach did some work on it.
Yeah, what's fascinating about those accounts is that people weren't really that startled or even scared about saying, well, it's an airship. Yeah, it must be some inventor trying to come up with this new discovery, because humanity was entering the age of discovery, in which science was bringing us all these new things, almost not on a daily basis, but more often, you know, than ever. So people weren't really that, something weird in the sky. Well, there must be some new invention that these people are coming up with. And as opposite as maybe in medieval times, people will see something in the sky and say, oh my God, is the devil or is the fae folk, you know, it's a Magonian ship. And then that kind of narrative kind of still maintained during the 1940s and 1950s, you know, if people saw something weird in the sky, they will probably naturally assume it was some kind of experimental aircraft.
Right.
And I guess we're returning to those kind of ideas nowadays, when I guess most people will start to think that what that weird light in the sky is probably a drone instead of saying, oh my God, aliens.
It's an interesting bell curve, this journey from entrepreneurs to aliens back to entrepreneurs.
It's interesting.
Yeah, we have so much technology now, and it's so small and so cheap that it's really hard to say, unless the light in the sky does something really different.
Exactly.
It's hard to rule it out one way or the other.
Or daylight sighting of, you know, some sort of non-conventionally structured craft.
Right. But even so, you have to say, you know, was it a experimental craft?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Who knows what the government has at this point that they're not sharing with the general public?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
So it's like, how do you know what to weed out and what not to weed out? I think if you see something that looks like a non-conventional craft and the thing zips across the sky almost faster than you can blink, probably not a test craft.
Exactly.
Or a falling leaf pattern.
Yeah. Okay, so here's what was interesting. I don't know if you guys listened to the interview I did last week.
Part of the reason I brought it up.
Yeah, where Willette was saying that in poltergeist encounters you get the falling leaf pattern, and I had no idea.
Oh, and I didn't listen to that one yet.
Yeah, he said that, you know, so in poltergeist cases, you'll often get the falling leaf type of thing of like irons or other heavy objects dropping like a falling leaf, which is one of the comparisons he makes with the UFO phenomena possibly being like poltergeist phenomena.
Ah.
But it's like, that's really interesting. I didn't know that poltergeist stuff had falling leaf-like patterns, and why the falling leaf, you know? Like, why is that the thing it does?
Hmm.
Why is it dropping like a feather?
Yeah, I think he really does have a piece of puzzle nailed down.
Yes.
Not sure if he has the whole puzzle. I actually don't think he has the whole puzzle, but he has some of those pieces, or he's got them locked in place, I think.
Yeah.
The only thing I wholly disagree with I can't even say wholly, but like some of his comparison, like saying, well, this is what was happening at the time and that's what influenced this poltergeist case. I think he's reaching a little bit. And he's not saying that's exactly what happened. He's just giving a sort of a guess. Well,
mm-hmm. And the method is very helpful for explaining flaps, and not quite as helpful for explaining individual sightings, or, you know, really mundane sightings within the definite UFO parameter. Not saying that, you know, UFO sightings are never mundane, but I'm talking about like the more, you know, the more simplistic.
Yeah, yeah. He does go on to some different ideas in the book that we didn't totally cover on there. I don't want to cover everything in the book because then people won't buy the book. Right,
exactly.
And, you know, a lot of times, no matter how much you talk to someone, you're not going to get the same depth you get from reading a book, because in the book, he can sit there and slowly outline everything you need to know and give you all the background and make sure he gets everything across. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he definitely seems to be onto something. Whether or not there is an other, or whether it's coming straight from us, I don't know. You know, I've always leaned right on that borderline there, where sometimes I think, no, this stuff is all us and we just don't realize it. And then other times I'm thinking, no, there's something else out there.
Yeah.
And there's no way to prove it one way or the other, because once you start accepting that it could just be us, where are the borders? Where are the limitations to that?
Well, you know, why does there have to be a difference between us and the other?
Exactly.
Well, sure, but that again comes back to it just being us.
Yeah, but also, but we are us and we are the other.
Like I always think of like synchronicities and stuff, you know, when we see this and someone will say, yeah, there's an intelligence out there and it's creating these synchronicities trying to communicate. I think it might be our higher selves creating these synchronicities trying to communicate. You know, and I've compared it. I actually wrote a blog post at some point comparing it to being like a video game. Your higher self is playing this video game where it can't communicate with the character in the video game directly.
Yeah,
right.
It can only like manipulate certain things in its environment to try to get it to do what it needs to do.
Well, and how many times in the video game have you thought that you were doing something, or even you were pushing the right button, and it just decides not to, not to respond.
I love it. So the synchronicity will be like the giant arrow in the sky. I'm saying, hey, this way to the side quest.
Right, right.
Except it's far more subtle.
Yeah, for sure.
Because I always think when I get batches of synchronicities, I always think, okay, this is where I'm supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Or what is this synchronicity and why does it keep showing up? Because a lot of times it's ridiculous. Like Michael talking about... when we did the one show and he's talking about Sting constantly popping up everywhere he went. You know, I doubt it had anything really to do with Sting. It's just the universe's or his higher self's way with a sense of humor of saying, you're right where you're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
You're in the groove. Have some Sting.
Yeah, every step you take. Every move.
And maybe deep down he liked Sting way more than he realized. All right. So is there anything else that happened over the weekend you guys want to talk about?
Oh, shenanigans.
Yeah. Major shenanigans.
I sang My Funny Valentine to Red Pill Junkie. A karaoke.
I believe that would have happened.
Let's see what else happened. We learned about space mammies. So there's that.
Do I want to ask?
Micah Hanks was talking about an email he had gotten from a gentleman. A gentleman on Brown Mountain used to have a little roadside store where he allegedly had this corpse of an alien. And I don't think Micah ever got a chance to see it, but Micah has been very interested in what this might have been. Even if it was a facsimile, it's something that, you know, as lore keepers, we like to we like to at least get an idea of what it was. And right. He got an anonymous email from someone one time who says, yes, I went up mountain and saw the three teeth in the space mammy. We just found that that particular turn of phrase quite unique. So anytime we would refer to aliens for the rest of the weekend, it would be a space mammy. So anyone who sees me or hears me using the term space mammy, that's what it's about.
Nice. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Oh. All right. Well, I guess we should probably stop there. I mean, we're going to deal with some of the feedback we've gotten from the Nightmare Show.
Right.
We've gotten – I am – apparently Mike as well. Mike Hughes has gotten quite a bit of feedback and letters relating to this. So we're going to do a show talking a little bit about that in the near future. Mike couldn't join us tonight, so we were going to hold off on that. And so if you want to join in the conversation and send us any comments, there's a forum on wheredidtheroadgo.com. You can message me at stories@wheredidtheroadgo.com. You can message any of us if you go on to, well, let's see. What's the best way to contact you, Red Pill?
Twitter, at Red, Red Pill Junkie on Twitter. And Facebook, I also have a Facebook page. And obviously, the Daily Grail. You know, look me up at the Daily Grail. There is a contact email service. And I'm sure to get the email there. Also, I think Rimerica has an email address for me. So, yeah, there's plenty of ways to contact me. Although, obviously, the surest way is if you remote view me.
Oh, okay. Excellent. Joshua?
Just visit my website, joshuacutchin.com. There's an email form where you can still use my email address if you just want to go cut out the middleman. Is foodtaboo, FOODTABOO, @gmail.com.
But now you're writing a book on smells. Is it going to be smell taboo?
It's going to be smellofsulfur @gmail.com. No, nice. don't write that because it doesn't exist.
And on a last note here, did any of you see this article? And I'm trying to find it now, about this Indian pop star who died from a snake bite.
Was Indian or was it from Indonesia?
Maybe it was Indonesia. I was looking up the article right now. But talk about dedication.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was performing on stage with live cobras, and one of them bit her. And she continued performing literally until she collapsed and then later died.
Jeez.
Hmm. Yeah, here it is. Pop star in Indonesia has died. Irma Buol. Astonishingly carried on singing for a further 45 minutes before she collapsed in front of her fans. The 29-year-old is known for wearing snakes during her acts, but the cobra which she danced with on Sunday had not been defanged.
You know, it pales in comparison, but I once filmed a live concert DVD with a gentleman who I found out later had a migraine the entire time. It was very high energy, and he was the front man. Like, it was a very high energy show, and you wouldn't have known it if you hadn't told me it later. So yeah, I mean, it's some people. I think that sometimes the craft gives people a little bit of extra boost.
Yeah. Well, yeah. This also says it is understood she was bitten after she stood on the snake during the gig.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, why are you standing on the snake?
Yeah.
Don't tread on me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're standing on the snake and hurting it, then maybe you deserve to be bitten by it.
Possibly.
But I don't know. I mean, there's a video, but you can't really see anything all that clearly from it.
Well, as long as we're talking about videos, have you seen the River Thames?
I have not. Video? I heard about it.
It's really interesting.
What's your take on it?
I mean, there really isn't a lake monster tradition, river monster tradition in the Thames. So I'm sort of thinking maybe part of me wonders if perhaps it was. Perhaps it was a submarine of some description, either, you know, a friendly submarine, or if it was a spy. I don't think a spy submarine could get that far up the river without somebody noticing. But, you know, maybe it was a Russian submarine. Who knows? I do find it interesting that in the city with so much surveillance that another video of it hasn't surfaced somewhere.
Yeah, well, that's true. And if maybe there is another video and they don't want to release it.
Possibly.
So I just watched that little video there of the girl. It looks like she might have stepped on the snake accidentally.
That's no good.
No. And I'm wondering if it was supposed to be defanged. Said the pop star refused treatment and carried on singing before she started vomiting and collapsed.
That's a lot like it was in her rider to have it defanged and someone didn't read the rider. It's like that old, I think it was it Van Halen with the brown M&Ms?
Yes. Yeah. I didn't actually look at the River Thames video, but wasn't there humps on it?
Yeah, something like that.
But it's so quick. It's so quick.
Oh,
it's not even up for a full second.
Hmm.
It's definitely worth a look. There's something there.
I have a still image there. Yeah, you can see it. There's definitely something there, but. It could be the top of a craft of some sorts. Or maybe it's just a very large marine animal. Doesn't have to be a monster.
It could be a whale. Yes, it could be a whale. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, maybe turned slightly on its side or something. It's interesting.
I don't think it's a hoax. I don't think it's a...
No, it doesn't look like a hoax.
No.
I mean, not everything weird is a hoax anyway.
Right. Yeah.
It's just videos are so easy to hoax nowadays.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
And some of them are so ridiculous.
Yeah, it's its own cottage industry of hoaxing videos.
Oh, yeah.
And you got to wonder, I mean, you'll see millions of hits on these things. Are people being suckered in? Are they really just believing it? They're already believers, so everything seems real to them. Or are they just going, oh, look at this nonsense?
I think it's the latter. I think it's like people are expecting to be entertained.
Yeah, well, that would make sense. But I'm sure there are some hardcore believers out there as well who are just like, no matter how bad it looks, they're going to be like, no, look at that.
I don't think anybody even gives it as much thought as you've given that question, sir. I think it's just like, it's like water through the gills of a fish. It's just, I need content. And they watch it and they move on.
Yeah.
And some of them are very well done. I mean, they're obviously fake, but at the same time, they're very well done.
Yeah.
Yep.
Speaking of that, did you guys ever see the video? I know Whitley Strieber posted it at some point, of the two like white things walking up the guy's driveway.
Yes, and it's really creepy.
It is extremely creepy. And I don't remember what they were called, but they're one is like really, really small, and the other one has like these really long legs, and it was caught on the guy's driveway cam or whatever. And there's a few other videos of them out there.
Was it the video of the rake?
No, it wasn't the video of the race.
I think they're called the walkers.
Yeah, I think they're called the walkers. That sounds about right. And I think it was Fact or Fake tried to replicate the video.
Yeah.
And they couldn't do it. Yeah. And they're like, okay, well, if it's a fake, it's a really good fake because I don't know how they did it.
Yeah, it looks really alien, you know, in motion and all. I mean, as an animator fan, you know, if that was something done... and I think it probably was done, if it's a fake, with analog means instead of a digital forgery. It was really well crafted.
Yeah, you can tell easier with digital. I mean, that's the thing with CGI. No matter how good CGI looks, you could still tell it's CGI. Even if you're not consciously able to tell, there's something that gives it away.
Right. Sometimes there's a fluidity there that really doesn't jive with the way that physics in the modern world is still it's messy, but it's also kind of rough still, and I don't think a lot of CGI really gets that when it comes to rendering cloth or it comes to rendering fur or something.
Yeah, and the fact that these images, these figures were so inhuman, literally in shape.
Yeah.
I mean, even if you remember the controversial video of the Duende from Argentina. I mean, that still is like, you know, some kind of humanoid shape, or a Bigfoot, or a gray alien like peering on the door of some abductee that is then charged of pedophilia. But anyway, these walkers are so, you know, non-human in shape. I think that is what added to the creepiness of it.
Yeah, I just watched the video and I'm not going to be sleeping tonight, so there's that. You guys have a tendency, you guys have a way of doing that for me.
What's the video called, Joshua, so people can look it up?
The one that I found was Strange Alien Stick-Like Creatures Caught on Security Camera Above Fresno and Yosemite Video Tests.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So probably not the same one, but yeah, there's a creepiness to them. Whether it's real or not, I would assume it was faked somehow.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe not. Who knows? There's weird stuff out there. And I guess if it's something alien is going to be caught on camera, I would expect it more to look like that, actually alien, than, you know, something more human.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
But it also could have been like, hey, what's the most alien weird thing we can film going down a driveway, and how can we do it?
Mm-hmm.
Because you can never underestimate people's creativity and talent.
Well, and you also can't underestimate how serendipitous you can get really uncanny results with simple methods. I mean, one of the great things at Paramania was Greg Bishop was talking about his UFO hoax that he perpetrated. Yeah.
What was this? Which, I don't know this
They
one.
Used to have these events called Kookouts back in the day, and they'd all go out into the desert, and he thought he'd play a prank on everyone and create a UFO test. So, or UFO hoax, rather. So he actually got a Chinese lantern with a glow stick inside, I believe. And correct me, Miguel, if I'm ever wrong on this. But he was going to attach it to some helium. And the first time it didn't work, and as it turns out, the actual Chinese lantern portion didn't work. So he just sent it up just the glow stick. But the way the glow stick twirled and twisted in the wind made it actually more effective and even more uncanny than what he was originally expecting. So he goes up to hang out with his friends, and they're all going nuts over it. Well, not really going nuts. That's unfair, because they were all interested in these subjects. So they were all looking at it like we would look at it, like, well, what is that? Could it be a so-and-so? Could it be a so-and-so? And finally, after about 15 minutes, they noticed Greg wasn't saying anything, and Greg bursts into laughter.
Yeah. Well, at least they were questioning it.
Exactly.
And I think with any of this phenomena, that's the most important part, not to just jump to conclusions, but question the hell out of it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Not dismiss it, not accept it, be in the middle somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, and to have the presence of mind and say, you know, was that a, you know, what is this? Is this an aircraft? Is this, you know, earthquake lights? What could it be?
Yep.
I found with some of my experiences when I see something and really can't explain it, like the giant UFO over the lake, it's almost annoyed me. Because I'll be like, all right, it's not this, it's not this. What the? Damn it, it's a UFO. and I feel like, no, I should be able to figure this out. And then you realize, no, it's actually what it looks like. There's no other better explanation. I mean, I don't know what that means by saying it's a UFO, but, you know.
I give up. Yeah.
I've gone through all the rational expected explanations, and it doesn't fit any of those even remotely.
Yeah. Damn it, not another UFO.
Well, sometimes you have to surrender to the uncertainty.
True, true. All right. Well, I thank you guys.
Hey, our pleasure.
Great conversation. And glad to hear Paramania went so well.
It was fantastic. Everybody stay tuned. I'm sure we'll be talking about the next one sooner rather than later.
All right. Later, guys.
Take care.
Bye-bye.